If you work for a company or organization, you want to believe you have a pretty good idea of what the company or organization does. And while you may have a firm understanding of your particular area, there may be other areas that aren't familiar at all. Well, Ohio Farm Bureau employees had an opportunity to learn more about food during an employee event. Coming up, we'll talk food safety, food insecurity, and food trends on Town Hall Ohio.
This is Town Hall Ohio, home to interesting people, engaging issues, and enlightening stories. Town Hall Ohio is a production of the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation, working to forge a partnership between farmers and consumers, and is supported by Nationwide. Nationwide is on your side. Now, here's Town Hall Ohio host, Joe Corneli.
Hello, everyone. I'm Dave Russell, sitting in for Joe this week. Well, an opportunity to help Ohio Farm Bureau employees understand the food industry more fully and to help explain how the organization approaches the many segments of the industry from farm to fork was all part of a day-long employee event. Executive Vice President Adam Sharp.
Yeah, we've been trying to think about our employees and their interaction with the food industry and with farmers. And we have many, of course, employees who have a strong background in agriculture, but we also have, you know, some people who are, you know, great specialists that work for us who do not have an agriculture background. Or as we know, the diversity of agriculture, some of us know a lot about one part of ag, but maybe not about another. So what we've been doing is three times a year is taking staff out and interacting either on the farm or talking about the food chain in the food industry.
Interesting, at this event, they brought their kids too.
Yeah, in the summer, we try to do a family event and invite the whole family and the kids to come and talk about different things with either food or agriculture and try to have some activities and things for the kids to do as well as the adults to learn a little bit and interact. And, of course, the main part is for us all to get to know each other better. We have a lot of staff, and one of the opportunities we like to do this three times a year is make sure everybody gets a chance to get to know each other better, because we always got new people coming on board and those of us who work in different parts of the state.
You mentioned that this program is has an emphasis on food. Some interesting conversations being had at this event.
Yeah, today is all food. So we talked food safety, and then we talked dietary and health and food preparation. And next we're going to talk about food trends. So today is all about food, and then a little food sampling too. And then, of course, that always leads into, you know, lunch and other food as well. But yeah, today is all focused on food and food safety issues and food issues.
So how will your employees be able to use the information that they pick up here today?
Well, it's both. So for today, there's obviously good information just for us as individual consumers. So there's that part of it, so that we hear and understand and learn about some things that are happening in the food world. But also, as an organization that represents agriculture and farmers specifically, it helps us also see things, trends that are happening across the food chain, things that we should be thinking about, things that we should be aware of that may not be directly from the farm side of things in production, but are certainly things that are important in the food chain.
So what's next for Ohio Farm Bureau and the staff?
We are probably going to venture up to Northwest Ohio to our water quality discussions and see the demonstration farms that the Ohio Farm Bureau, in partnership with the Natural Resource Conservation Service of USDA, have put together. And these are farms demonstrating some of the newest, latest technologies and or tried and true practices that have been shown to have conservation benefit for water quality. So we're going to take everybody up there next.
Ohio Farm Bureau Executive Vice President Adam Sharp. Well, when talking about food, a good place to begin is food safety. Leading the discussion with Ohio Farm Bureau employees, Abby Snyder, an assistant professor and food safety field specialist at The Ohio State University. Before talking specifically about foodborne disease, Abby described her role at Ohio State.
Yeah, so my interest is in microbial food safety and quality. So that prevents people from getting sick or from getting spoiled foods. In extension, I work with a variety of different stakeholders. So that includes industry members, so food producers and farmers and growers, as well as regulatory groups, other community groups, and then consumers directly. And so some of my responsibilities are also with the cooperative extension system. So family consumer science educators that are based out in the county and doing food safety programming are also some of the people that I work with.
So where did your interest come to get involved in this area?
I grew up on a farm in southern Ohio. My family's from Ross County originally, and I was involved in a lot of agricultural youth organizations growing up, including 4-H and FFA and some of the Farm Bureau programs. So I knew I wanted to be in the College of Agriculture, and food science offered a lot of the technical content that I was also interested in. So food microbiology became my primary interest before I attended graduate school.
Well, let's talk about foodborne disease. Is it a problem in this country?
Yeah, I mean, I think you make a good point there that we have a potential misconception that we have a perfectly safe food supply, and we definitely have a very safe food supply. The incidence of foodborne disease or the incidence of contamination is relatively low. But if you think about all of the different foods that are consumed every day, there still ended up being quite a few cases of foodborne illness. So there are, the best estimates we have are that about 1 in 6 people get a foodborne disease each year, which I think is surprising to people to hear that that's what happens in the United States. Most symptoms of foodborne disease are mild. It tends to be vomiting and diarrhea, which is bad and can cause you to miss work. But we still also have about 3,000 deaths and 128,000 hospitalizations as a consequence of foodborne illness.
So is it even possible to think about zero risk when it comes to foodborne disease?
No, and it's misleading, I think, to go down that path. So getting consumers and industry members to make risk-based decisions is the path we want to go towards improving food safety. But part of that is recognizing that there is no zero risk. You're making decisions to lower your risk, both in terms of the severity of the hazard and the probability of something happening. But there is not really a viable situation where you could have zero risk. So we make decisions around the best possible trade-offs that are available.
So let's look at it from a consumer standpoint. Do we as consumers recognize those risks?
Yes and no. I mean, I think if you survey people and you ask them, you know, what should you do to a hamburger to make sure it's safe, and questions about hand washing and those kind of practices, people tend to know that they should be doing them, but I would say behavioral changes are a lot harder to achieve. And so, again, that goes back to your question about do we have a risk-free food system, and that answer is no. And so appreciating what risks are out there can help consumers make better behavioral decisions to mitigate their risk. Now, I'm not saying people have to do certain things at all, but being informed about what risks actually exist help people make more informed choices.
We are talking with Dr. Abby Snyder, a food safety field specialist at The Ohio State University. Well, when talking about behaviors leading to foodborne disease, leaving food out too long topped Abby's list.
Yeah, this definitely happens all the time. I mean, I'm guilty of it too. So guidance will talk about the danger zone. So basically having food at close to ambient temperatures where microorganisms can grow and either increase the cell number or produce toxin in some cases. And the issue with toxin is that even reheating will not necessarily destroy the toxin. But it can be hard to manage, especially at large events or if you're traveling distances. And the consequences with temperature abuse are often more mild, so things like vomiting and diarrhea as opposed to a high fatality rate. But it is one of the more frequent problems that result from consumer mishandling that lead to foodborne illness.
So is there a magic number when it comes to how long food should be left out?
Yeah. Depending on your source and when you last looked at it, those numbers can vary slightly. But in general, between 40 degrees Fahrenheit and 140 degrees is considered the temperature danger zone. If you have a food that's between 70 and 140, you should keep it out for an hour or less. And if it's between 40 and 70, you can have up to 2 hours.
Well, number two on Abby's top 10 list of behaviors leading to foodborne disease, canning vegetables in boiling bath water, which Abby says is a big no-no.
Yeah, I mean, Ohio should have a lot of emphasis on this. So in 2015, there was an outbreak of botulism in Lancaster due to improperly canned potatoes that were served at a church potluck later. And that led to a death and actually a really large incidence of botulism. And even before that, in 2008, I think there was another incidence of miss home canned vegetables leading to an outbreak of botulism in Ohio. So this is the case that is kind of the opposite of the first example you just mentioned of temperature abuse. So both of these are toxin formers, but botulism occurs much less frequently, but has a much more severe disease consequence. Much higher fatality rate, long-term consequences for people who do survive it. And it's a misconception that is surprisingly prevalent among people with even a lot of canning experiences. So if you're making a low acid vegetable product like green beans or potatoes or corn or carrots, that needs to be processed in a pressure canner, and your county extension agent or county extension educator can provide you with more information on that.
So pressure canning is okay?
Yeah, it's not to say that you can't preserve these products, but you need to do it correctly. And so the issue here is that the pathogen Clostridium botulinum produces a toxin that it's a neurotoxin. It can cause paralysis, and it causes you to stop breathing. That's what happens. And so pressure canning kills the producer organism. And so that's what you would need to do for low acid canned foods. And high acid foods like traditional jams and jellies, it's the acid that prevents toxin from getting produced. So those can be processed in a boiling water bath. So all of these, I want to be clear, people still have a lot of flexibility in what they're able to do, but they need to appreciate risks exist so they can make the right management choices.
We are talking with Dr. Abby Snyder with the Ohio State University, talking about top 10 behaviors leading to foodborne disease. Up to number three, convincing themselves that farmers are immune.
Yeah, this would apply to lots of people who feel like they have exposed themselves to a lot of different hazards already, and that they grew up in dirt. So if it hasn't made them sick yet, what's going to make them sick going forward? And I know that a lot of this is actually also promulgated by authority figures in the community, and so I'm always surprised to hear that. And sure, there's some evidence that suggests that if you grow up on a farm or have a pet in the house, you have a more robust immune response, but there's certainly not data that would suggest that you can use that to base a risk management decision around. So even, for example, if you have the most robust immune system, you are still not supposed to process green beans in a boiling water bath. It doesn't matter how good your immune system is. So don't rely on that as an indicator.
Well, there is a lot more to come on this week's Town Hall, Ohio. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Abby Snyder and her top 10 behaviors leading to foodborne disease. We'll also talk with Michelle Moskowitz-Brown, the Executive Director of Local Matters, about food insecurity. Plus, the food editor at the Columbus Dispatch, Lisa Abraham, talks about the latest food trends. Thanks for joining us. And just a reminder, you can listen to previous Town Hall Ohio broadcasts by going to the Ohio Farm Bureau website, ofbf.org, and clicking on the Issues tab. Or Town Hall Ohio is available on iTunes. I'm Dave Russell, in for Joe this week. Back with more Town Hall Ohio after this. We are back talking about food this week on Town Hall, Ohio. I'm Dave Russell, sitting in for Joe. Dr. Abby Snyder is a food safety field specialist at The Ohio State University. She's sharing with us her top 10 behaviors leading to foodborne disease. We are at number 4, relying on made-up standards.
I think that this is most commonly attributed to cooking meat and determining when something is done based on arbitrary or visual standards. So to make a burger safe, you need to cook it to an internal temperature of 160 degrees Fahrenheit in order to activate any pathogens. But many times people don't use a thermometer to assess temperature. They look for something like the color, or they ask for a burger to be well done or medium. Or they cook it until the juices run clear. And those are poor proxies for safety. So they're correlated to temperature. Like if you have a really pink burger, you know it wasn't cooked very long. But it's unclear whether or not it's been cooked to 160 degrees. The only way to know that is really to measure the temperature. So use the actual guidelines. You know, don't try and smell a food to see if it's gone bad.
Number 5, using foods in a way that the manufacturer intended.
Yeah, so that's what you should be doing, is using them in a way that the manufacturer intended. People get in trouble when they start using them in unintended ways. So some of those examples could include consuming flour raw. We saw this with an outbreak about a year ago, and we don't normally think of wheat flour as being a major risk for food safety issues, but it's produced in the natural environment, so fecal contamination is still a problem, and it's raw flour, so it hasn't undergone a thermal process yet. In those cases, people had been consuming flour in raw cookie dough, or they had given it to children in the form of pizza dough at restaurants, or maybe in homemade Play-Doh where you use raw flour. And so there's no thermal process. It's not like people are consuming large amounts of raw flour, but it poses a risk. Now, manufacturers themselves are also very savvy. So they have what they call unintended but reasonably foreseeable uses, and they will also try and decide fail-safe safety programs around that as well. So they have our best interests in mind there, but there are things consumers can do to protect themselves too.
So eating cookie dough is a no-no?
Yeah, so you should follow the instructions on the package. Now, I will say, I guess with hesitation, if people are going to take this as godsend, that a lot of manufacturers know that people eat raw cookie dough raw, so they will take extra precautions. They will use pasteurized liquid egg instead of shell eggs that haven't been pasteurized. They'll use flour that's been treated instead of raw flour to help reduce that risk, or they're moving towards that at least. So there are extra cautions that the manufacturers take, but like I said, if you have a question about it, you should read the label, and if it's been processed in a way that's safe for you to consume raw, sure, but otherwise follow the manufacturer instructions.
We are up to number 6 of the top 10 behaviors, and that is preparing food while you're sick.
This is a tough one. I mean, I don't think anyone didn't know this. It's just hard to actually live by those standards. And this is particularly true in retail and food service settings. So a lot of the employees at restaurants, it's hard for them to take time off. If they're not getting paid, they might not have the days. And that is a huge contributor to outbreaks associated with restaurants. Norovirus is the particular concern there. In home settings, it's often, you know, one particular food preparer that bears a lot of responsibility at large gatherings. And so making sure that it's possible for that person to avoid handling foods if they have vomiting and diarrhea is an important way to protect your family.
Number 7, consuming raw foods.
Yeah, just in general, as a practice, some sort of thermal process like cooking or pasteurizing eliminates potential hazards. That's what it's there for. And raw foods, by definition, haven't gone under a thermal process, and so the potential contaminants are going to still be there.
Number 8 of the top 10 behaviors, managing anxiety rather than safety.
As an industry, we often expend a lot of energy talking with consumers about their anxieties associated with modern food production. And we spend very little time talking about actual safety hazards. So we might focus on how consumers feel about additives rather than discussing the real challenges associated with salmonella. And so I think we should acknowledge consumers' concerns as valid, and we should always discuss things in terms of risk, right? Nothing is zero risk. So trying to persuade people that something is 100% safe is ineffective risk communication. But I think there's a lot of benefit towards an industry that becomes increasingly transparent about the challenges it actually faces. And it gives consumers more power to make more informed risk management choices.
Number 9 on your top 10 list, thinking that this has never made me sick before.
People tend to think, well, I have done this for so long and I have never gotten sick, therefore I will continue to do it and continue to not get sick. And as I mentioned, there's a very low contamination rate within the U.S. food supply. So the fact that you haven't gotten sick before might just be because the food supply is so safe, not that you are just going to be immune from all of those consequences.
And number 10, thinking that the U.S. food supply is 100% safe.
So this is kind of a synthesis of a couple of the points. That number one, the U.S. food supply is safe. The incidence rate of contamination is very low. But number two, we should be candid with consumers about the challenges and risks that do exist with safety in the American food supply. It enables consumers to be more savvy with their risk management decisions, and it puts the emphasis for producers on the challenges that exist rather than sometimes on those food safety myths.
Dr. Abby Snyder, Food Safety Field Specialist at The Ohio State University. In our next segment, Michelle Moskowitz-Brown, Executive Director of Local Matters, joins us on Town Hall, Ohio.
It smells like winter in our house. Smells like bean soup, chicken soup, soup with macaroni, cream.
Welcome back. I'm Dave Russell, sitting in for Joe Corneli. During an Ohio Farm Bureau program for employees, staff heard about a program addressing food insecurity from Michelle Moskowitz-Brown. Michelle, first of all, thank you for taking a few minutes here to visit with us today on Town Hall, Ohio, about local matters. First of all, for folks that maybe aren't familiar with it, what's it all about?
Local Matters is an organization that provides education, access, and advocacy all across Franklin County and also expanding across the state, essentially with the idea that everyone should have the skills, the tools, and the resources to eat well and feed their families.
So how long has the program been in existence?
We were founded 10 years ago, and it was really as a response to this notion of children having being predicted to have a shorter lifespan than their parents. So that's when we knew we had a call to action, essentially, to address that.
So let's talk about the mission of Local Matters.
The mission is to create healthy communities, so to change what currently exists, where 50% of adults have diabetes and pre-diabetes, to really have a culture of health through this food education, access, and advocacy. So our mission is to create those healthy communities in partnership with people, you know, individuals, organizations, other nonprofits, city, county officials, et cetera.
So is Local Matters, is it a model, or is it something that that is a result of maybe another program in another part of the country?
Well, there are organizations like us, but we are unique in terms of an organization that really concentrates on hands-on food education that is generally taking place for, you know, a minimum of 10 hours. So you really have that chance to create behavior change. And we work with diverse populations. So it kind of makes us unique because we're working with folks in recovery, people with developmental disabilities, preschoolers, seniors. So really unique in our sort of community development model and in our in-depth education and sort of coupling that with some policy work that we do.
So you mentioned the program's been in existence for 10 years. Is it making a difference in the areas that you're working?
For sure. My biggest goal is to affect change. That's my highest value. So I wouldn't be here if it wasn't. I've been with the organization about 6 years. So what we're seeing is that we're able to take, you know, children who prior to our class, only 15% of them were eating the required daily allowance of fruits and veggies. So after the class, 45% of those kids are really meeting those requirements. So that's one example. We also find that in our program that focuses on addressing food insecurity, that people are less likely to run out of their food dollars. And then we're seeing that even in conversations with doctors, that the conversation is starting to shift. You know, we understand they have a limited amount of time to talk with their patients about food, but their growing interest has really been, we've been able to leverage that and help them acquire the skills that they need because they're not getting this nutrition education in their medical schools.
Local Matters is a nonprofit. What are your biggest needs?
You know, we are a nonprofit that has really grown by utilizing diverse revenue streams. And I would say, in order for us to continue to grow, you know, it's not so much that we need to figure out how the model can scale a bit more. So I'd say for us, it's how do we reach everyone in the state of Ohio? Because we can't be everywhere. So I'd say right now it's about planning, you know, to implement, you know, continue to implement across the state. So that's one area of need. And then I would just say sort of, you know, every year you're raising the same budget. So, you know, having more stable revenue sources, that's a big need for us, which is why we developed Wellness Matters to help us have that engine there that can help us be flexible and adaptable so that I'm able to dream big and not just worry about payroll, right?
So how do we go about getting this into more communities statewide?
Right. I think this train-the-trainer model is really a positive way to get that done. So we can come in and actually train a whole school system like we've done in Marion City Schools, where you've got a great food service director. She knows what to do. She certainly knows how to get the food prepped every day. So we'll just do 2 days of training with her down in our kitchen here. Then she'll go back up, implement with the teachers, and then we come up and do some quality control, help them with evaluations. We're able to kind of handle that back end of you don't have to develop all those systems. We've got that down, but you can just kind of take this. So that's one way to get it into your community. I'd say also, you know, if it's something that you like to do just as a parent, let's say, you can go to our website. You can look at Alliance for a Healthier Generation and get some sort of, you know, ideas for workshops you can just conduct at your school. Maybe you want to have a smoothie station or a salad making station at one of your school events. Get your PTO, PTA involved. And that's really, I think, where more change is going to come from, the grassroots level.
So in order to participate in Local Matters, do I need to be of a specific economic class?
No, we really go where people are. So generally speaking, you know, you're going to find us when you're enrolling for classes at the Central Ohio Diabetes Association. If your kid's at the rec center, you're going to find our classes. We'll just kind of be there. And then we also have a central kitchen across from Children's Hospital where we have a sliding scale. So it really is everyone from six-year-olds to mom and grandma cooking together, and it's students and it's maybe donors and volunteers of our organization, and that's ideally the best mix where we're all just cooking together. We're just people cooking together and enjoying a meal.
I can't thank you enough for taking a few minutes to visit with us about Local Matters. Best of luck down the road. Hope you meet all of your future goals.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
We'll talk food trends when Town Hall Ohio continues.
Mr. Natural, just as healthy as I can be. Oh, but at night I'm a junk food junkie. Good Lord, have pity on me.
Lisa Abraham is the food editor for the Columbus Dispatch, and during the Ohio Farm Bureau employee event, she talked about a number of food trends. The biggest trend she sees? Addressing food waste.
Yeah, food waste is probably the biggest overriding issue facing the food centered population, but facing the country in general and facing the world in general, because we're starting to see really startling statistics like, you know, billions of tons of food every year that are going to waste. And yet we see on the flip side of that, parts of the world are still very hungry. So there's sort of become this awareness that we cannot continue to, number one, produce food at the rate we have been just to waste it. And number two, that we need to do something to make sure the food we are producing is used conservatively and is used for something other than feeding our trash cans.
So because it is becoming a trend, how are folks going about making sure that they're not contributing to the problem?
You know, you're seeing a lot of really creative sort of synergies, especially among businesses. You know, one of the newest trends now is aquafaba, which is bean water. It's that kind of slushy water that's left over when you drain a can of chickpeas. And vegetarians have embraced it because of its properties. It can be whipped into a meringue. And because it can be whipped and it will hold into a suspension form, it's become the basis for a lot of foods that previously weren't available to vegetarians. So now there's a product out there called Fabanaise, made by Sir Kensington. And it's a vegetarian mayonnaise. So you're seeing this kind of synergies between companies where I have something that I'm not going to use, but someone else can make use of it instead of just discarding it, sort of recycling it or upcycling it, turning it into something better.
We are talking food trends with Lisa Abraham, food editor for the Columbus Dispatch. One of the other big trends, this one probably no surprise. Millennials.
Oh, that's for sure. 18 to 35-year-olds, they are really driving the bus these days. They are really setting the stage for what we, even older generations of consumers, are going to be seeing. Their habits, the way they like to spend their money, how they like to spend their money on experiences rather than things, is really starting to drive everything. Including our food experiences. So, you know, you're going to see a lot of places where you have interactive dinners, where you go and you are part of the staff that actually prepares the dinner, and you go with a group of friends and you all go to a restaurant where you pay $50 a head and you help the chef to cook the dinner. So you have the interactive experience, and maybe you've learned something along the way, so you aren't just paying for the food, but you're paying for the experience. And millennials, more than any prior generation, are experience-driven, and they really are, they're driving the economic bus.
Well, let's talk about some other food trends. And one of those you mentioned is reigning royalty. Now, you had bacon still as king, but there's a new player.
There are. Vegetables are really the royalty of the food chain these days. And it's not because we're seeing an increase in people going full-on vegetarian or full-on vegan, although it tends to run pretty steady at 20% of the population for any given time. But what we're seeing are people who are just opting not to eat meat a couple days a week. You know, 5-10 years back, we saw the Meatless Monday campaign starting, and that really has taken hold. You know, if you look at millennials, you see a lot of them still struggling with the economy and the job market. You still see a lot of 20-year-olds living at home with mom and dad. If they do go out on their own, they're facing really high rents, or they're facing the prospect of 3 or 4 roommates. And so they have to be careful with their money. And vegetables are always cheaper than meat. So you're seeing vegetables are really riding a high. We're seeing things like vegetable butchers. Cara Mangini, who is a Columbus entrepreneur, opened Little Eater in the North Market. Her first book, is called The Vegetable Butcher. She started out as a vegetable butcher in New York City at Mario Batali's Eataly. So she likes to talk about using different vegetables and knowing how to cut them to prepare them so that they excel best in whatever dish you're preparing. Because you're going to cut zucchini one way if you want zoodles, and you're going to cut it another way if you want to make a stir fry or a saute.
You also mentioned when it comes to vegetables that canning is back.
Canning has been on a rise ever since the recession. The recession really started people looking for ways to raise money, and surprise, surprise, they found out that grandma knew what she was doing when she would grow a couple of tomato plants in the backyard and end up with enough to can sauce that would last her through most of the winter. So that became a real trend again, and it has stayed. It's now a widespread hobby, and every year you see the numbers of people who are practicing home canning and home preserving just going up and up. And sometimes it's not even canning, but just freezing, which is, of course, we know is another way of home preservation. But not necessarily canning with the pressure canner like you think about, or the boiling water canner that you think about. But certainly preserving the harvest has become very trendy, and I don't think it's going to go away anytime soon.
The children of Ohio Farm Bureau employees have their own food-related activities. We'll talk about those when Town Hall Ohio continues. Well,
before we wrap up this week's Town Hall, Ohio, Bonnie Ayers, Dairy Youth Program Specialist at The Ohio State University, talked about the children's program at the Ohio Farm Bureau employee event.
Oh, that's a super opportunity for the employees to bring their children to have them learn about agriculture. And what a collaboration it is here with Ohio State. But I think this today is assuming that 2% of our people even live on farms anymore, and the employees are working for a farm organization to bring them closer to home and what the goals and aspirations of the people are through their kids. What better way? We have all learned enormous amounts of things because our kids have drawn us into it.
Did I understand that you incorporated ice cream in your program?
Oh, yes. Everybody got to taste the ice cream, ice milk, ice yogurt, and it's an opportunity. We even do this in the basic animal science class with kids. We do a lot more interest in labeling and defining ice cream and the legal aspects. And besides, Ohio is a mecca of ice cream. And one of the ways on our home farm that we've learned to connect with consumers is making our own ice cream from our Guernsey cow milk. So it's very local. Now, we're not big time, you know, out in every store, that kind of thing. We have what we can manage and what services the needs of speaking to the consumers. And then we always like to have people at the farm. I'm not a big advocate of the word transparent. It's just who we are, people. This is what happens, you know, and this is how we live and sharing that lifestyle.
We are talking with Bonnie Ayers at The Ohio State University. Bonnie, you worked with younger children here at this Ohio Farm Bureau employee event, but the students at The Ohio State University, how are they changing as far as how are they coming into the university? What's their knowledge about what you're teaching?
Well, we're going to talk about, we have more and more the non-traditional student. And the popularity of the animal science major has increased so much. And it may be the lure, the romance of being with animals in more of a companion way than a utilitarian way that we have looked at it previously. So we have to look at a historic content. And then, you know, there's a lot of difference in the generations. I'm a baby boomer, and I've raised the other generations, and there's a whole different attitude. And that's not a positive or a negative. It's a point to work on, to blend together, because eventually they're going to take over our roles, and in their own way, they will progress and do things very right that maybe we should have been more aware of, but vice versa. They'll forget some of the things we were very good at, and maybe we will have to make some corrections. But the non-traditional student is not the student that was born and raised on the farm. We're getting more and more kids coming from the non-rural areas, from suburbia, from big city, because they're interested in animals. And there is a huge job prospect out there for people in agriculture, food sources. And we can see that even on our own cable network, TV programming, and in life, where the emphasis has been. And it's going to have to be some of those college graduates that come through the College of Food, Agriculture, and Environmental Sciences. They're going to help us make the transition.
Bonnie Ayers. Another group providing interactive activities was the Ohio Soybean Council's Grow Next Gen program. Jane Hunt is the education consultant.
That day we had students who were creating soy ink using common products, Kool-Aid powder, vegetable oil, which is soybean-based, and soy lecithin with a little bit of water. And the students were able to make different colors of ink, understanding, hopefully, that vegetable oil and water don't mix very well. But when you add soy lecithin as a surfactant, it helps to mix those two pieces. And then the students were able to use stampers and actually make cards or designs with those stampers using that soy-based ink. So showing how soy ink is made. The other activity that we did with some of the older students was to engineer an egg catcher, because egg farming in the state of Ohio is pretty large. And one of the things that needs to happen is those eggs need to be collected safely and efficiently so that we don't lose them. So what's the best way to collect eggs from a chicken that's laying one egg a day, and how do we manage to do that in a large-scale facility? So, of course, we were modeling that activity, and then we also showed them a video about how it really happened.
And that's this week's Town Hall, Ohio. For Joe Corneli, I'm Dave Russell. Thanks for listening.
Town Hall, Ohio is a project of the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation and is brought to you with the support of Nationwide. Nationwide is on your side. Join us again next week for Town Hall, Ohio.